Hello and welcome back to Corpus Cast, part of the Aston Original series, providing fresh perspectives from Aston University experts. My name is Robbie Love, and I'm a lecturer in English language here at Aston University. I'm a corpus linguist, meaning that I study linguistic patterns, trends, and variations using large samples of language data. So on behalf of the Aston Corpus Linguistics Research Group, welcome to the show. Now, Corpus Cast is all about corpus linguistics and what it can do for society. And in this series, I'll be speaking with top researchers in the field to find out more about how corpus linguistics can be applied to a diverse range of areas. So in this episode of Corpus Cast, our topic is research into discrimination in a range of contexts. And my guest is Dr. Mark McGlashan, Senior Lecturer in English Language at Birmingham City University, just down the road from us at Aston, where he's also the Associate Director of Research at the Birmingham Institute of Media and English. Now, Mark's research uses methods from corpus linguistics and critical discourse studies to study a broad range of social issues, including nationalism, racism, sexism, and homophobia. His recent work has focused on combining these interests with computational methods for the collection and analysis of large amounts of online social media, forum, and news data to analyze the language of things like rape threats, far-right nationalism, and anti-Semitism. So today, I'll be having a chat with Mark about the role that corpus linguistics plays in this research into the broad area of discrimination. And so without further ado, I'm very pleased to welcome to Corpus Cast, Dr. Mark McGlashan. Hello, Mark.
Hi, Robbie. How are you doing?
Very good, thank you. How are you? Thank you for coming on.
No, very, very happy to be here.
Oh, brilliant. It's great to have you here. And as I just said, you've done work in such a range of areas, but we can broadly kind of frame that within the context of discrimination. Before we talk about some of those topics, I want to start with a broader question about corpus linguistics. What does corpus linguistics mean to you?
Yeah, very broad initial question. Corpus linguistics, it's a really exciting, very vibrant and like quite radical field. So you could take the approach that it's a set of theories and methods and ways of approaching linguistic analysis, but you think about the way in which corpus linguistics has kind of revolutionized linguistics, and now its tentacles are spreading into digital humanities, and the kinds of methods and approaches that are taken for granted in corpus linguistics are becoming revolutionary to the humanities and human geography. Yeah, the applications are really, really broad. So you think about the kind of context where I am now, Birmingham Institute of Media and English. How do you apply linguistic methods to media text? And you look at how corpus linguistics has been combined with critical discourse studies for pretty much decades now, and the ways in which we can analyze media text using linguistic methods. It's just testament to what corpus linguistics can do, its power, as an approach. So what it means to me is, it's my career. It's a really exciting, vibrant field, and I love doing it.
So how did you get started in corpus linguistics in the first place?
Probably very similar to yourself. So studying at Lancaster University, undergraduate, working under Professor Paul Baker, I had a seminar tutor at the time, Claire Denbury. So introduced at undergraduate level, loved it at undergraduate level, master's and then a PhD. So my PhD was really I was mostly interested in critical discourse studies and applying critical discourse studies to the analysis of the representations of same-sex parent families in children's picture books. So we might talk about this later on when we get on to talking about discrimination. But I was really interested in how to interpret representations in a large body of texts. So my PhD was trying to combine this primary interest in how is a historically marginalized population represented in children's picture books. Well, how do you do that at scale? How do you look at linguistic representations over a large number of texts, but also how do you then combine that with multimodal approaches as well? So Yeah, my interest is mainly a research-based one. Corpus linguistics is the set of methods, the theories, the approaches that allow us to do really interesting things quite quickly, quite powerfully with language. And so, as you said, in your introduction, spotting those patterns, trends, things that occur in a large body of texts, and it's all empirically based. So we're looking at real instances of language use and trying to find those patterns and trends.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but do you sort of have an example, or do you have a memory of sort of one of the first times that you looked at corpus data and learned something that was, oh, wow, this is such an interesting way of looking at it? Do you have any memories of one of the first things that sort of convinced you that this was a really interesting way of looking at language?
Yeah, so it goes back to Paul Baker again, doesn't it? So his book, so Using Corpora and Discourse Studies, and during seminars where it was, obviously you're learning the rudiments of corpus linguistics, so you're looking at grammatical patterns, you're looking at collocations, you're looking at concordances, and then as we move through the syllabus, it was towards discourse. So how do social representation, well, how do you look at patterns and trends in social representations? And one of the first examples was looking at representations of boys and girls in the BNC. So how boys are kind of strong and adventurous, whereas girls are pretty and small. So there's this like this real kind of at scale coded representations and index, well, ways of indexing gender around those ways of representing gendered identities. So that was very much in the undergraduate level, and then taking that into obviously deeper interest later on. So when I started working for CAS, so Centre for Academic Centre for Corpus Approaches to Social Sciences at Lancaster University, where we started to look at rape threats as part of the Discourse of Online Misogyny project with Claire Hardacre, who's PI. Lancaster, really.
Since Lancaster, you've been working now for a few years at Birmingham City University, and you've continued to develop an interest you just mentioned there on online misogyny being an example, and more broadly radical online discourse, I suppose you could call it. And I mentioned before nationalism, sexism, racism, homophobia, things like that. You've done quite a lot of work in this area in recent years. We'll ease our way into this topic now. So I know it's not necessarily the most pleasant topic to discuss, but broadly, what are your objectives when exploring these sorts of discourses? Why is it important to you to face up to looking at these quite challenging discourses in online media?
Yeah, interesting question. It probably comes down to very central concerns in critical discourse studies. So how are certain marginalized identities represented, or looking at ways towards emancipation. So thinking about who is marginalized, how are they marginalized, why are they marginalized? And you think about the kind of the mediatization of issues around, particularly misogyny. So in the past couple of years, we heard a lot of things about rape threats. We've heard a lot of things about rape culture, the kind of sexist abuse, which is pervasive in schools. And we have projects like Everyone's Invited, or Everybody's Invited, online, which are collecting experiences of especially young women in schools who have been victims of sexual harassment. And these are all things that are socially mediated. These are all things that are done linguistically, the kind of things where people slide into DMs and harass. So the objectives are mainly to understand. So there are interventionist objectives, so finding ways that might be suitable for challenging those kinds of negative representations. So, for example, early on in, well, before I joined CAS, I held a event in the House of Parliament with Tony McHenry and Paul Baker, where we took my PhD research on representations of same-sex parents in children's picture books, and presented my findings from well, the Corpus Linguistic Inquiry, but also findings from people outside of academia, practitioners, teachers, people in the publishing industry, working with MPs, and those kind of publishing stakeholders to say, well, here's a social problem. Homophobia is pervasive in schools, and there's been Ofsted reports and Stonewall's reports in previous years to say that homophobia is pervasive. So how can we potentially intervene based on what we know might be positive representations in children's picture books with gay parents? So if you know homophobic behavior is prevalent, how can we maybe represent gay, lesbian, bisexual, trans couples, people, identities in more in positive ways and present those to children in a way which is suitable to those age groups?
So was the issue that there wasn't enough of that sort of representation, or that the representation that was there was problematic, or both, I suppose?
Well, mainly, yeah, not enough. So there was there's a real backlash, or there has been in previous years. So you can look towards Section 28, and when I was growing up, which feels like a very long time ago, so between 1998 and 2003, you had Section 28, which was you are not allowed to talk about homosexuality as a pretended family relationship in any child, well, child-directed kind of institution. So the government effectively banned talk about homosexuality mm-hmm. in schools. So there's been a historic lack of representation, but that also creates a marginalisation. I think things are positively changing at the moment. So there's more educational programmes, and due to the Equality Act, and we are talking more about LGBTQ plus identities in schools, which is a good thing. But yeah, I'm not an educational practitioner in those areas, but I know diversity and inclusion is much higher on the agenda. That being said, the current government and current talks about between politicians, I think this anti-wokeism kind of strain of politics at the moment, we could be looking at some quite regressive attitudes coming back and being popularised again. So there's a vital agenda here. So understanding the ways in which political correctness, for example, the discourse around political correctness has now changed to wokeism. Like, how does language change, or how is language used during the different time periods to represent similar things and keep marginalised identities marginalised? What's the context around that? So we can, Corpus Linguistics is a way to look at those patterns and trends and changes all the time.
So how is your work received in Parliament? I mean, well, first of all, what was that like? I mean, I can only imagine that was quite a scary experience, but also how was it received when you did that?
Yeah, it was very positively received. So it was kind of like a special interest group meeting. So it was people who were invited to the meeting, industry spokespeople, sympathetic MPs. So we had a Conservative MP at the time, Eric Ollerenshaw, who was working in Lancaster, and Stephen Twigg, who was working in West Derby from Labour. So they were quite sympathetic to it, and it was very well received. Everybody kind of said, yeah, this is the kind of thing that we need to be doing. We need to be looking at ways to, if bullying is a problem, and bullying is a problem, if homophobic bullying is a kind of problem which is extremely prevalent, and it's resulting in things like suicide and self-harm and these real problems for children, what do we do about it? How do we make some interventions based on what we know? And if we're looking at literature as one way to encourage just discussion, like positive discussion and inclusion around identities which have been marginalised, how do we do that? So it was a lot of hard work organising the event, but I think it was very positive, but taking it forward then the hard bit. So directly after this meeting, so I was able, because of Eric Ollerenshaw's connections, to go and meet Liz Truss very briefly after that meeting, who was at the time, she was the education secretary. So we had a very brief meeting, which it was, okay, why do you want to do this? Go and get me some evidence, talk to the National Association of Head Teachers, go and talk to all these agencies who are already quite well aware of the problems that exist. So it was a bit more than you step into the world of politics, and the world of politics moves either extremely slowly or extremely rapidly. Working with politicians, it can be a tricky thing.
It sounds like it. Who knows? Maybe you met a future prime minister.
Yeah, very potentially so.
Yeah, at the time of recording, at least.
Well, it felt quite scary then. It feels quite scary. Yeah.
Don't worry, I'm sure she won't watch this. So you mentioned before a word which I think is an interesting one. You said that you had an interventionist agenda. So if we sort of think about the work you've done on online discourses, try and unpack that a little bit for me in terms of what can you do to sort of go in there? Are we trying to protect the people who are targeted by this quite extreme discourse, or is it about preventing it from happening in the first place, or automatically detecting? What are the kind of interventions that you have made or hope to make with this sort of work?
I wouldn't characterize it as an interventionist agenda. I think the primary agenda for us as corpus linguists and linguists in general, people who are dealing with social problems, is to understand the problems, try and spot those patterns, behaviors, trends, in the way in which things are linguistically mediated. But I think the aims of being able to, we're not in the business of behavior profiling, we're not in the business of being journalists, we're not in the business of being big software companies writing algorithms to detect things. But what we can do is provide empirically based observations about these behaviors, which might be useful to then understanding the problem. So when it comes to things like nationalism, for example, there are extremely good people working in conflict studies, war studies, those kind of areas, nationalism, social sciences, criminology, sociology, who understand these groups through anthropology, through interviews, however they might observe these cultures. They know the language that they use, they know the symbols, they know the way in which they operate and organize. So we as linguists, what we can do is go a little bit deeper, so we also know what those areas are finding. What can we find? Ways in which people communicate. Find out, so as corpus linguists, what is frequent? How do these patterns associate with each other? Which kind of combinations of, say if you look at the far right, for example, so you might use a code like 1488, so 14 represents Adolf Hitler, A14H 88, and that might correlate with something like, which I've found in some of my studies on the Football Lads Alliance, might have things like 1488 plus pro-Brexit. So you might have things like these coded symbols of nationalism plus other things that are going on. So how are things used together in co-occurrence, collocation, that go beyond maybe just having these kind of word lists of, well, these are dangerous things that might present a signal on Twitter, for example. So if you have somebody puts in 1488, or they put in Sig Heil, or they might put in whatever that might be associated with one of these groups, that might give Twitter a little red flag. But is it somebody critiquing it? Is it somebody saying, oh, these idiots using 1488 in their profiles? Mm-hmm. There are inherent problems with producing algorithms. And as linguists, we need to remember that our primary focus is on understanding how language is used in context.
So you've also I want to ask you about another quite distressing topic that you've recently published research on with Samuel Lana, I think, up in Manchester, children's online disclosures of sexual abuse. Again, what led you into this area, and how does the use of corpus methods kind of help you to, I suppose, understand their experiences?
Yeah, it's a particularly awful thing to look at. It coalesces around a range of interests that I have. So I'm generally interested in the treatment of children, so how the society view construe and construct childhood. So what is the child? But then also these dangerous aspects or these, socially very negative topics of homophobia, nationalism, racism, homophobia, these things that lead to just these pretty horrible subjects. So I met Sam at a meeting at Aston, really. It was the launch of IAFL, so the Aston Institute of Forensic Linguistics. I met him at the launch of that, and he was interested in looking at the Childline message boards, which are a freely accessible resource for children to go to seek advice and read advice from Childline. So they act as a message board, and children can post anonymously. So Sam was interested in looking at how children go about making disclosures. He wasn't really focused on a particular topic, but we saw that there was message boards for sexual abuse and emotional abuse and physical abuse. And we were both interested in how are these topics talked about, how does Childline handle them. So we worked with Childline and had approval from Childline to work with these anonymous posts. So we collected a lot of posts, so a couple thousand of them, to look at how children talked about domestic abuse. So when we've got these message boards that talk about abuse, how do children talk about domestic abuse? And so corpus linguistics, what the approaches allowed us to do was to look at those patterns and trends and ways in which there are commonalities but across different forms of abuse. So we've looked at domestic abuse so far. And obviously there are representations or ways of talking about feelings, and we have these cognitive things. So things that I think and things that I want or need, so potentially using those as ways into finding what most children are looking for when they make a post anonymously on Childline. But also these feelings, or how do certain forms of abuse make you feel? And we're exploring that in more depth. So we've only looked at domestic abuse so far, but we're going to go into looking at sexual and physical and emotional abuse, so trying to disentangle those behaviors. So there's already a kind of macro, just by the design of the message boards, there's already a macro kind of structure of these topics. So if somebody wants to talk about a particular experience of sexual abuse, they would maybe see the message board and then post in there. So yeah, trying to disentangle those behaviors and look at maybe patterns across those. So are there certain feelings which are associated with emotional abuse? And we found that things like depression and anxiety were very much present in those emotional abuse posts. So you think about abusive parents or bullying at school, or relationships with older siblings or younger siblings. Patterns, trends, associations. Really,
how do you sort of maybe cope isn't the right word, but how do you manage with trawling through quite a lot of really upsetting and distressing accounts from children? Are you able to kind of block it out of your mind when you're not thinking about that work, or how do you manage with that?
That stuff I think is the most distressing stuff that I look at. So looked at rape threats with Claire Hardacre on the Dune project, and that was pretty horrible. So you're getting I'd hate to characterize it as trolling, but you get these kind of we found that there were these networks of people who were piling on and sending this abuse because it was seen as like something funny to do. It was that was pretty horrible. it felt a bit more contained, and we were working with Caroline Criado Perez, who was the focus of this thing, and there was certain overt ways that we were able to go in and make interventions, so talking to Twitter about what they might be able to do with our findings. Stuff like this is a bit more difficult because it's anonymous. There's no way to really directly intervene and help the children. You're reading all these a variety of disclosures, really quite distressing stuff, and obviously Childline screen before they're allowed to go online to make sure that they don't have any personally identifiable information. But it is involving children who have no control over these things. They're powerless, like essentially socially and materially, like generally quite powerless individuals. So stepping away from that or coping with it is not nice. I don't think I don't think there's any one way which works for everyone. I think that trying to maintain the ethical integrity of a project is important. So making sure that you're kind of checking in, and it was good that me and Sam were working together, so we were checking in with each other, making sure that we were both okay. Working with Sam was kind of working with Childline to make sure that at each step our work was in line with what they were kind of expecting. But yeah, stepping away from the data, working with it, and I think corpus methods they do kind of help you to. I know that it can be a criticism sometimes that it helps you step away from the context, but it does allow you to step away from the context, observe the patterns, and then prepare yourself for going in to look at individual text associated with certain patterns. So say if you want to look at how somebody is, I don't know, if there is a specific form of abuse mentioned, so bullying, can you set yourself up for that data? Okay, I'm going to work on some stuff about bullying today for a couple of hours and then step away. But it's extremely emotionally and mentally taxing. But I don't think we'd do it if it wasn't important.
You mentioned the sort of ethical perspective there, and of course another big part of a lot of the research you do looking at online discourse, I suppose, you know, from a data protection perspective or an anonymity perspective, what's your general approach from an ethical perspective to gathering these large data sets of online use of language? Is it a free-for-all or are there really careful considerations to take when you're approaching gathering what people are talking about online?
Yeah, I think, again, it depends and it varies. So, for example, technologically and technically, so if you look at the Childline message boards, for example, they are freely available. Anybody can go to those message boards and read the disclosures. And if you wanted to sit there and copy and paste and collect them for yourself, that's essentially the same without all the technological stuff like an API or ways to collect them quickly. It's essentially the same as having anybody's random website. So anybody could go to my website and copy everything, and that's theirs. The same with Reddit, for example, or Twitter. Twitter has APIs, so there is a technological interchange for you to go and grab loads of data, but Twitter limits you. Same with Reddit, so they allow you to take certain amount of data. Working on things like Childline, I think these are already vulnerable populations of vulnerable people. Working with the people who host that material is really important, so to make sure that you're working with them to protect the child, making sure that the work that you're doing is in line with the eventual aim, which is to help even Childline to understand better the kind of disclosures that are being made to them. So that's the main focus, is helping Childline and helping the children downstream, really. If you think about other projects that I've kind of been involved in, so yeah, the rape threat stuff with Twitter, we were able to scrape all those tweets that mentioned Caroline Criado Perez or were directed towards her. The ethical considerations were not to name the people who were involved, so deleting handles and things, but we were working kind of with Twitter to present the work to them eventually. With Reddit, if you think about, again, the kinds of communities that, it's me, Alexandra Crandall, who works at Lancaster University, so she's just passed her PhD, doing really well, and she's working at Edinburgh University at the moment as an associate lecturer. Veronica Collar, who's a prof, I believe. Prof at Lancaster University. So we've been doing some stuff on the manosphere, so these dangerous online communities, well, extreme masculinist communities of online, online communities, which are particularly misogynistic. So all these people who have anonymous identities on Reddit in these communities, which are kind of open source, anybody can go to them, search for them, find them, spewing vitriol about women, suggesting that women are plates to be spun. Mm-hmm. Women are there as a kind of sexual object in order to be used, mm-hmm. objectified and thrown away. So dealing with those kind of populations, I think, is slightly different to dealing with children who are making disclosures of abuse. So we might have disclosures on Reddit, for example, but the same kind of things apply. Anonymity across all the data sets, so person identifiable information is stripped out of them all. Reddit has a different framework for when you collect and use data. To Twitter does try and stay within those technological boundaries, but also we have responsibilities as researchers. So thinking about what I was saying earlier, what we're interested in is observing those patterns, making empirically based observations about how language is used in particular communities. So we can provide the context, but we're not interested in saying that person's done this, so let's go and find them. So you might have these internet pylons where you have doxing, for example, that happens. Trolls who might try and identify people and post their address online. We're the diametric opposite. So we are interested in understanding how these ideologies work in language, how language is used to reinforce ideologies, create and maintain certain social practices, marginalize other people. So how are women construed and constructed and represented in manosphere groups, for example? Same with these rape threats. And then, for example, if you look at the Childline data, who are the most common perpetrators, for example, who is performing actions that result in certain abuse.
Yeah. Do you ever worry that, you know, by going out there and publishing research about online groups, like you mentioned, the manosphere, people who have very extreme derogatory views about other groups of people, do you ever worry that leaves researchers like you vulnerable to being seen as an enemy by these groups? Or do you feel, where's the line there in terms of, you know, you've got to obviously share your research and tell people what you're doing. That's the whole point. But also by doing that, you know, you're potentially vulnerable to being seen as someone who's opposed to what they're doing and trying to stop them, maybe.
It is a worry. It's necessary work. I think if you were working in law enforcement, for example, like you would not be named. You are not personally identifiable unless somebody's tracking you or whatever. It is a worry. I know earlier on in my work, and this is to do with kind of public accessibility to research. So the most problems I've ever had with the general public sending for. I had one death threat, and I had a particularly awful letter when I held the event in Parliament, and that was the day that the event was held in Parliament was the day before the legislation for same-sex marriage went through, and so there's a particular media context in which my event and my research made sense to report on in the Telegraph at the time. So I got named as a researcher at Lancaster University, so I got this anonymous envelope with Michael Glashan, Lancaster University, and I came into my pigeonhole. So that's about as close as I've come to stuff like that. But then you don't know. Mm. It is a worry. I don't know. The main thing is understanding. So I think the job is to find out what is going on in those communities, because the people who it directly affects isn't really me when people are talking about abuse, talking about sending rape threats to a particular individual, or especially these manosphere groups, so that the targets are women. And well, we have a certain, I don't know, it's a tricky question. I don't feel particularly worried, but then also I don't really fancy going poking in the hornet's nest either.
Yeah, probably the best. So you're preparing at the moment to lead a project aiming to improve online safeguarding for children in schools. You recently were awarded funding for this project. So what are your plans with this work, and what role will Corpus Linguistics have in contributing to this project?
Yeah. Cheers for the lead-in. We've recently been awarded a UKRI Innovate UK Knowledge Transfer Partnership project, working with between Birmingham City University and a company called Renato. So they have a piece of software called Sensor Cloud, which is an enterprise management solution for schools. So what they do is they provide safeguarding solutions for online communications in schools. What they have is a problem with, well, number one, identifying potential instances of safeguarding issues. So schools all have a person called a designated safeguarding lead, and this person is responsible for working within the school to identify and make sure that any issues about safeguarding, so things like anything to do with abuse, welfare, duty of care character, duty of care issues and the Equality Act characteristics, so anything to do with discrimination, threatening behaviour, X, Y, and Z, extremism, the prevent duty, all that kind of stuff comes under safeguarding. So the software that is available is able to identify certain forms of safeguarding issues, but it's not quite accurate. It tries to capture too much. So the idea is to try and, well, implement corpus linguistic methods to look at patterns, trends, associations, trying to look at empirically based empirical language use around some of the protected or some of the characteristics that they're interested in capturing. So things like self-harm, health issues, radicalization, political extremism, racism. So how can we use linguistic research about racist discourse, online cultures of online radical communities like incels, for example? How can we look at patterns in those communities? Is that evident in children's use of networks at school? So we know that there's a certain amount of mainstreaming, for example, of manosphere discourse. So in the manosphere, you might talk about things like cooks. So somebody being a cook, which is derived from cuckold, which is somebody who is, typically a man whose wife sleeps with other men in front of them, and this is a masculinating discourse. So you might have cooks, and you might have things like even the word incel. You might have things like simp, which is again somebody who demeans themselves in order to attract a female partner. So they'll do things which the female partner wants them to do, irrespective of who they are. Well, if it's some detriment to them. So the kind of language that is evident in these communities, is it present in the children's language, and does that represent a safeguarding issue or potential safeguarding issue? Obviously, not just looking for those terms. It's much like extremely serious stuff. So things like suicide, self-harm. All of that kind of stuff.
And you're go ahead.
No, go on.
I was just gonna ask that you're currently recruiting for this project, is that right? Feel free to give it a word.
Yeah, I think it's on jobs.ac.uk. If you go to my Twitter account, I don't know if you're gonna put my Twitter on on the podcast or anything.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's 2 weeks to apply. If you'd like to ask any questions, I'm more than happy to pick up the phone, or if you go to my Twitter profile and click the link, you can get directly to my Teams and we can have a face-to-face chat. So yeah, we're recruiting. The 15th of August is when that closes. And it's a really exciting project. So it run for 2 years, working with the company, and the company are extremely enthusiastic about what they can do for children's safety as well, because this is working both nationally in the UK. So their market, well, they're a company, they have certain things that they're interested in. So they have a profit motive, but they also have a safeguard motive as well. So their market share of UK schools is growing. They're also expanding quite rapidly internationally, so in the US market as well. So it's an excellent opportunity to be part of both a university where we've just had an outstanding ref result. We're doing extremely well in terms of research, and there's a lot of exciting research going on, and also part of a really exciting and growing business who the main thing is, how do we use corpus linguistics to do socially important stuff? And I'm not very articulate when it comes to this stuff, so I really do. I'm just do good stuff using really, really complicated methods.
Well, I think it sounds like really important and interesting work. So I wish you all the best with that project, and I can't wait to see what comes of it over the next couple of years. You'll be relieved to hear, Mark, that we are making our way to the end of the episode, and we're going to finish by pitching to you three quick questions, and we're going to find out whether you win the or become the record holder for the quickest answers, because quick questions, as I've discovered on this podcast, don't always lead to quick answers. Here we go. Not to put any pressure on you. Here we go. Question number one of three. What are the biggest changes you've noticed in corpus research since you began working in this area?
How long have we got? I'd say immediately in response to that, I went to a inaugural plenary for Jack Grieve at Birmingham University when he first became a prof. And one of the things that I really took from that was, and this was as I was starting to do a bit more in this area, was he said that linguistics is becoming a data science, or becoming more like a data science. So data science approaches, coding is kind of a much more fundamental skill. So I know when I did my undergraduate and master's, there was no provision for coding. And half my job now is probably programming in Python and R to do things that concordance is, well, and conk is fabulous. I did my PhD using AnConk, but it is restricted to AnConk and what AnConk can do. So yeah, data science, we're not just looking at words in a lot of ways now. We're not just looking at text. We're now looking at, we're not just looking at a corpus as a big lump. Mm-hmm. We're also looking at a corpus as lots of texts with lots of authors, with lots of variables, with lots of things that we can look at with triangulating those variables. So looking at the data and language use as a much more complicated thing. So it's not a quick answer. And like one example is when, for example, two ways of applied this. When we were looking at rape threats, it was looking at language and how language correlates with social networks. So how do we plot, for example, concordances and frequency lists and collocations onto things like a social network? So when we have text produced by users that contain certain linguistic things, how do we map those in a network? So we've done that using Twitter data, but also using, Twitter data again to look at vaccine misinformation during. I would be remiss to not mention another project that I had, which was with Andrew Keogh, Professor Andrew Keogh, Associate Professor Robert Lawson, and I think she's a senior lecturer, Tatiana Grieshofer at BCU. So we had and Matt G, and also Dr. Selena Smith. So it's a pretty big team. trackcovid.com if you're interested in it. But we use the data derived from that to look at social networks. So biggest change, corpus and data science.
Very good. Okay. Question two. What is the biggest misconception of corpus linguistics that you've encountered?
Word lists and dictionaries. Next question.
Brilliant. And finally, you made up for the first one. How will corpus linguistics make an impact, or I suppose continue to make an impact on the world in the future?
I think that as it continues to proliferate, so it's going to have academic impacts for a long time. So again, this has been talked about quite at length, corpus linguistics having this Brandon problem. So it's not quite NLP, it's not quite topic modeling. Well, it's definitely not topic modeling. It's not computational linguistics, or is it? We operate in this quite small little, very friendly, very collegiate, and also like quite dynamic bubble. But yeah, so what do? The kinds of stuff that I'm interested in is, emancipation. How do we look at things like discrimination? How do we look at those social problems by using corpus linguistics as a method? And I feel like that's kind of in and of itself, this proliferation of the method. It is a method that allows us to do really interesting things that get us to an endpoint. The tools and the methods and the approaches sometimes aren't the end point in and of themselves. Like, there is a place for that, and it's really important that we interrogate and critique and question the science and the approaches. And if you look at anything to do with statistics in the last 20 years in corpus linguistics, that's going on, that's happening. Mm-hmm. Is it log dice? Is it log ratio? Is it log? Is it this? Yeah, what is it? Impact on the world. I think, even looking at the KTP, that way we're going to apply corpus linguistics, that real world application of not just throwing an NLP tool chain at a problem, because that's where we get into problems where you don't detect effectively safeguarding issues. It's understanding that there is a place between the snazzy techie stuff and the linguistic, understanding the grammatical, the functional grammatical, the contextual, the critical approaches to linguistics. So yeah, proliferation.
Well, I look forward to witnessing this proliferation over the years to come. And with that, we will bring our conversation to a close for this episode of Corpus Cast. So thank you very much, Mark, for joining us. It's been a really, really fun and interesting conversation. And thank you, our viewers and listeners, for joining us once again. However you've accessed us, whether that's on YouTube, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Podcast Addict, or even Podchaser, if you will. Please let us know your thoughts about this and other episodes using the hashtag CorpusCast, and make sure to check out the Aston Corpus Linguistics Research Group on Twitter at Aston Corpus. Corpus Cast is an Aston Originals podcast written and hosted by me, Robbie Love, and produced by Sam Cook. And thank you once again for watching, and thanks again, Dr. Mark McGlashan, Birmingham City University. It's been a pleasure to speak to you today. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.